Spirit Radio Podcasts.
I have the one and only Therese Davey for this week's Home and Lifestyle Tips. Well, Therese, the pressure I put on you last week clearly worked because I said, you got to come in with some Christmas goodies, and you have delivered. You have some beautiful little mini mince pies. They're only mini, so I've already devoured one. And Alex will give out to me later when we talk nutrition. And some gorgeous homemade jam. Tell us about the jam.
5 different apples. Great year for apples this year. Apple and clove jelly, which is gorgeous on toast. And dead easy to make. And you can make it in a small batch and you strain it and you add some sugar and some cloves and you're off. Lovely, lovely, lovely thing to make and to pass around. And now I have loads of these to give away. And you were on the giving list this morning, everyone here. And you've got to share that with everyone here for the
sharing is caring.
And the other two things I want you to try, and I say it every year in case you haven't tried it. Yes, absolutely. Try something new. And the one to try this year is sharon fruit or persimmon. You'll see them in Aldi.
Okay, so sharon fruit looks kind of like a giant orange tomato. Is that a good way of describing it?
Okay.
Because the skin is very smooth. Well, how would you describe
it? I'll accept that. An overly large orange tomato with a little leaf thing at the top, and you peel it and you slice it and it's absolutely gorgeous. And
where do they even come from?
I have no idea, but they're very old.
Somewhere
fruit
exotic.
And they're very tasty, and they're the kind of thing you could put in a salad when because they're not hugely sweet.
They're not overly
soft.
Sweet. They're kind of a honey flavour.
They are actually, and you could use them in a salad. They'd be absolutely lovely. And everyone's talking about smoked salmon as your starter for Christmas Day. I say something cool like that on a salad with some cheese, or how about Parma ham and melon, something cold and refreshing. But the second thing I brought into you was something that's a staple in our house every Christmas, and that's spiced beef.
So this is Tom Durkin's spiced beef.
Well, we get ours in Clark's Butchers in Sligo, because your local butcher will have their own recipe for making spiced beef, and they've been marinating for a long, 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 long while. But if you just want to try it, if you go to Super Value, they have trays with 6 slices of Tom Durkin's spiced beef, which is absolutely lovely.
And you see, what makes this festive is just looking at the ingredients. So it's spiced with cloves, black pepper, white pepper, nutmeg, ginger and cinnamon. Obviously, different butchers will have different recipes or whatever, but it is kind of festive ingredients, essentially spicing the beef. And you can certainly get the cloves and the nutmegs. Lovely.
And what people and we have it on Christmas Eve. I go to a particular house and they have the freshest of white bread, and they make these little sandwiches with the spiced beef, and I put my cranberry salsa on it, and I sent the recipes in for that, and that's lovely, and that goes down really well in our house on Christmas Eve with all the visitors.
And just actually, as you're speaking of sandwiches, and something that was just so lovely yesterday was over in Fran's house, and how we can kind of complicate things when people were calling over. We popped in and they had done a big dinner the day before with the ham and the turkey, right? And my friends said, I'll just whip up some sandwiches, and made some lovely turkey and stuffing sandwiches, some plain ham sandwiches. It was so simple. It was so lovely. No stress for her using the leftovers. So we can totally overcomplicate it, can't we?
Absolutely. And if you keep it simple with the good ingredients, it's easy peasy. And on the subject of keeping it simple and getting it right, my website of the week is safefoods.eu, where they've loads of recipes on how to store, how to cook, how to stuff and how to defrost your turkey. I see the ads on television about defrosting your turkey for 24 hours per certain weight. I'd never thought of that, the weight for defrosting, until I read it in the website. So that's where you go for all your tips. Just the one website. It's great.
And check that your turkey fits in the oven as well. If you've got an extra large one, that's kind of key.
And there is a way around that. If that happens to you, do not panic. You can cut the legs,
off
and do them separately. You can cut the bottom off the turkey off, get the saw out, sterilise with some vinegar or vodka or something, and cut the bottom off the turkey off, and you have your own crown as you would get in the butcher shop or in the supermarkets. Do not panic. You can solve this one.
But really good tips on the Safe Food website, because I think the piece of research they did, it said something like 15% of people are cooking the turkey wrong, and by wrong they mean in a way that could give you food poisoning. So it's serious enough to actually just know the juices are running clear, all that sort of stuff, and every oven is different.
Absolutely.
So even though there's a guideline of cook it for X amount of time depending on the weight, it is extraordinary how you could do, say for example, there might be a lot of people to raise that or I'm over in my mother-in-law's on Christmas Day. Now, I could be cooking something in her oven that I've cooked 20 times on my own, but it'll cook totally differently there.
Yeah.
And you kind of have to be aware of that.
Because the fan button is on and it's going to cook faster and quicker or something, or dries out and you haven't been basting it or you haven't turned it or whatever way you're choosing to cook it. But you are so right. So a little bit of thinking about it beforehand is worth it. Absolutely. Take the time to think about it properly.
You have another website of the week.
I do. MyKidsTime.com. Great tips for coping, and particularly with sensory overload. And I spoke about this last year about children and all that happens to them with the food and the sugar and the television and all that
and
happens.
And the lights, even.
Even the lights, the blue light that's coming off their screens. And so there's a great article on sensory overload and great, great tips on what to do there. And one of the best ones is get out there and walk there and have a down day and a fast day. Actually, I thought that was a clever one. What I've been doing this week, actually, for my sensory overload is I am overloading people with the sensory of candles. This is my present this year. I went up to the attic. Great to hear the guys talking this morning about how to use things out of the attic. Buy a bowl in a charity shop, buy something odd and fill it with all the odd candles, the packets, split them up and split them up between people and give people a sensory overload of different candles this Christmas. It was just something I was very conscious of doing instead of buying maybe a bottle of wine, do you know? I just
thought
maybe something different and reusing, as they said. And I was appealing to people's sensory nature with my presence this year. But my jobs of the week, there's a lot, Wendy.
I know it's a week where there's going to be a lot of jobs, but come on, it's Christmas, it's Advent time.
These are good ones, these are the
giving
ones.
No, they are, to be fair.
They are the giving ones. Check your elderly neighbours again to see do they want any other presents bought or letters posted. Where are they going for single lunch? Where are your single friends going for single lunch? Where are the people who've lost someone this year? What are they doing?
You know what, this was something I was reflecting on, Therese, and it's something that's really important to me and my husband, which is having our own Christmas traditions. And, you know, in the gospel, Jesus talks about having a seat at the table. Now, so far, we've been having Christmas dinner in, you know, my mum and dad's or his mum and dad's. But when we do get to the point where we're having our own Christmas dinner, and I have to say my parents have been great over the years of having a seat at the table for that person who was alone or widowed or whatever. And I think we were just saying for our kids that we have to get into that habit where they're really used to it could be a stranger, you know, sitting at the table, a stranger to them anyway, sitting at the table at Christmas. And I'd love to try and get into that. I mean, would it be so hard if you have a neighbour who tells you that they are alone at Christmas to just invite them over?
Absolutely not. It is the time to do it. And one of my jobs the week is to go to your local church or put on the Piano Guys Christmas version video and realise what we are doing this for. This is the season. This is the season to say, welcome Jesus and happy birthday, Jesus. And this could be your gift to him, inviting that stranger to the table. It'd be a lovely gift to give him, inviting that person who may be awkward, that awkward aunt, that maybe that awkward neighbour. I remember we had a Polish waiter who was alone one, and I remember going in to collect him in the hotel after he served Christmas lunch in the hotel and brought him out, because that's what we did in our house. All mum and dad's single friends, we brought them to the house, and it was different. It was just different.
And you know, it's gas you say about the awkward aunt, because I remember one year an aunt that was invited to Christmas dinner in my husband's family's house, and like that, when they were little kids, they saw her as their funny aunt, you know, and they didn't know what to make of her coming, as she was widowed and going to be alone. And can I just say, first of all, it was a beautiful dinner, but the joy that that woman got from not being alone, from being around family, from being with us, was more of a gift to us than it was to her, genuinely.
Absolutely. Bringing them home in the car and dropping them off home afterwards, and their pleasure. And seeing them going into an empty house and it's sad, but you had a couple of hours there, you share their time with them. Time is the most precious gift you can give people. But few more jobs. Please go out and buy more batteries.
I was just keeping talking so you wouldn't give me more jobs.
Yes,
but anyway.
I'm sorry. Go out and buy more batteries, including those little flat ones for those odd Christmas lighty up things that you bought last year in the sale. But the batteries have gone dead, guys, in the attic, and they will not work without the batteries. So go and buy a set of those flat batteries as well as the regular ones. You still need more sellotape and a few more stamps for those forgotten cards. Look at that list again. Have you got a Christmas card for your beloved? I'm not going to admit that nearly happened to me last year. But
yeah, you see, I buy these things, you know, happy Christmas to my husband, and then I forget where I put them and I end up having to get them last minute. So, you know.
Buy another tube of hand cream when you're in the supermarket to keep beside the kitchen sink, because there'll be a lot of washing going on and everyone needs to use it. Everyone in the house needs to use it. things to do if you're going home, like me this Friday. Well, here I'm giving a warning to everyone. Some security things. You need to check around the house. You need to fix some things. You need to make sure that your attic is leave the trap door in the attic open a little bit in case the frost comes so the heat can creep up. Check your heating system is coming on for an hour every day. Tell the neighbours you're going and leave that key with a trusted friend.
You can also get timers that you plug your lights into that you can set it, because they're one of the pieces of advice that came from the guards in our local area was burglars look to see, oh, is a light coming on at exactly 5 o'clock every day if they're on the kind of old school timers, because they know then you're away. But modern plugs that you connect up with an app on your phone, you can literally set it to a different time every day. Brilliant. And you can change the time when you're away. So you can decide, oh, I'll turn the light on now. So it's very hard to know if someone is or isn't at home.
Absolutely.
And another tip on the safety that, again, I saw just in a kind of neighbourhood watch form is just be extra vigilant. I know it's awful to think of it, but neighbours in our area were unpacking the car with the presents, the food shop, all that sort of stuff. The boot was open. In the time that they were literally carrying in the first bags into the house, a car drove up and took everything, including the bag of spuds. So you can't be too vigilant, you know.
And that's one of my next things. Never leave Christmas purchases visible in the car, and do not cover them with a blanket or a coat. It's more obvious.
We know what's under there.
Absolutely. And if your car is fitted with an alarm, make sure it's switched on when you park and leave the car. And my thing is, do not pack high things in the back seat because they block your view. I did that 1 year driving home to Sligo, and it was ages before I found a safe place to park to fix it. So please be careful what you're loading into the car as well. And other things like listen to the road map, the road routers, and the people who are telling you things, so you'll avoid the Christmas traffic jams on those Fridays and Saturdays, and stay out of the towns on the busy times, because you'll only frustrate yourself, make yourself more stressed. And a couple of things to do: don't be skipping meals over the Christmas. Drink loads of water. Give yourself some rest. You can do that. You know, you can say it's a time for rest as well, and take those times and get loads of fresh air out there, is what I'm saying as well. Christmas tree. Can I just say one thing about the Christmas tree?
You may. You can say two.
Okay. They're brilliant, but be careful with them. Make sure they're balanced properly. They won't tip over. And water it every day. I know I say this like a broken record. They drink a pint
That's
of water
the real
every
trees,
day.
Not the fake ones.
Yeah, the real ones. Cut the bottom off it when you get it home and give them a pint of water every single day. And make sure, my last thing, please check the smoke alarm, because everyone's lighting candles and using all kinds of things. And when you're using candles, make sure they're on a flat surface, they're in a sturdy container, and away from the Christmas cards and away from the children, please.
And as the mother of a very active toddler, and you know, if you don't have kids yourself, or it's been a while since your kids were that small, it's hard to have your eyes open, but anything that's like that at toddler or child, small child height, that they can reach and the wax can fall on themselves, and the people don't think of it. I was in a friend's yesterday, and little tea lights all on the little coffee table, and I just went and picked them up myself and moved them, because I knew they'd be gone and they'd be on the carpet, or of course could set fire to something. So keep your eyes open, not only for yourself but for little hands that might be in your house, you know, little people that aren't usually there, but because it's Christmas you've lots of people around, you know.
And blow them out last thing at night, one last circuit. Unplug everything, switch off those lights and blow out those candles. And just the last job, please go and find your local church and look at, and just remind yourself why we're doing all this. Go and watch the videos on YouTube of the Come O Come Emmanuel, the Christmas one, and just beautiful, and just see why we're doing this. We're celebrating a birthday.
Therese, as always, thank you so much for your wonderful home and lifestyle tips and your beautiful treats, thoughtful stuff you brought into us at Spirit Radio this morning. It has been a pleasure to chat to you every week during 2018. And here's to many blessings and many more chats in 2019.
Mentally, and it skewed our perception.
Of course, we are very close to Christmas Day now, and it is. It's such a, for many, a joyful time of year, a time of hope, excitement. But for some of us, and I think probably most of us at some point or another, it can actually be a time of huge stress and anxiety when they peak, you know. And just even this morning, thinking myself, chatting to others here in Spirit, where the conversations around this time, have you much to do? What have you done? What have you prepared? And sometimes even just anxiety around it being a difficult time of year can also be really difficult. So on the line to give us tips about, first of all, recognising anxiety and stress, but then giving us advice on how to deal with it, especially at this time of year when it can be even more heightened, we have psychotherapist Ronan Johnson from Zest Life Counselling. Ronan, good morning to you.
Hi, Wendy. Good to be back.
A lot of people would just say anxiety and stress is just one of those things at Christmas that everybody has. Should we just accept it, or does it get to a point where it's gone too far?
Yeah, I'm inclined to think that even a little bit is probably more than we need. The one thing, as particularly as time gets closer to Christmas, and it was funny, I was just up in Dundrum Town Centre yesterday, and just the look of panic in everybody's face as they wander around.
How manic it is! People are rushing around. Absolutely. You can actually feel the stress kind of exuding from people.
Yeah, it really is, and you get this feeling like, is there a Christmas police out there somewhere? You know, saying to everybody, you have to have this done, and you have to have that done, and you have to have these presents, and you have to. And actually, you realise that what's actually happened is it's like there's a kind of almost an external voice somewhere. I mean, it's not anywhere, but it's everywhere. A kind of a voice that says, whether it's in the pictures of, you know, good housekeeping magazine, or whether it's even the stuff we see on TV, that Christmas should be like this, or it should be like something. And one of the things that I think that we don't do for Christmas a lot of the time, particularly in this lead up, is we don't take a minute, you know, 60 seconds to just go, wait a minute, what would I like to see happen this Christmas?
What do I want?
You know, it may not be possible, but at least I'd ask that question rather than constantly kind of be almost following a different drummer, you know, the Christmas police drummer, whatever it is.
Well, do you know what's interesting about that, Ronan? It was one of these memes that made me laugh, but it's funny because it's true. And it was saying a mom's kind of Christmas wish list, and it was all fancy presents, and then said, okay, I'll be realistic, I just want 10 minutes to myself with a cup of tea, right? Exactly. Which I think a lot of parents would laugh at, or anybody really.
Yeah.
But
absolutely,
if that's what we need, which I think we all do every day, that moment of peace, of prayer, of time to just breathe, we got to make it happen.
Exactly. That is absolutely it. Even just to check in with yourself. Because if you think about it, a lot of the time, we don't even do that bit, let alone getting what you want. You don't even ask yourself what you want. So that's actually kind of what I would say is the start. And, you know, the funny thing is people tend to go, but, you know, it feels slightly self-indulgent, if you don't mind me saying. It kind of feels slightly like I'm babying myself. But actually, if I don't figure out what I want, it's going to be very difficult for me to help other people get what they want too. Because if I don't at least acknowledge my own needs, I mean, I may not be able to manage to get some of them, but if I don't at least acknowledge them, then I get really resentful and cross and fed up internally, and I tend to push back against what everybody else wants.
And therefore, it's counterproductive in a way, because you're not able to then ultimately do what you want, which is have a peaceful and restful time. What do you think are the most common kind of root causes of just feeling extra anxious at this time of year?
Well, I think one of the big things, you know, if we take the first thing, that idea that actually there is some notional Christmas that is a perfect one out there. That's one of the, and you know, it may not be the notional Christmas from the TV. It may be a notional Christmas that we learn from our mum or from our dad. Or every Christmas we always do X. And what happens is we get kind of enslaved to the traditions that we always had, you know? And while those traditions are fabulous and lovely and they may give us a great feeling of connection with people or meaning because we're helping others out, you know, the people who do something charitable every year and it's really important to them to do it. But the problem is that can start to become a little bit of a tyrant. We have to do it this way and it has to be done that way. And, you know, and it creates terrible, terrible chaos in families, you know.
Instead of standing back and saying, hang on, what works for us and for our family?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. A very interesting thing. I remember the year that myself and Joanne got married. It must have been, well, it was 1,000 years ago. It was about 28 years ago. But somebody in a pre-marriage course we had, they said, do something different every year for the first 5 Christmases. And it was the best advice that we ever got, because actually we did. By the time we were 5 years in, everyone was like, I don't know what they're at. I don't know what they're going to do this Christmas. And actually what it did was it meant it gave us a bit of time. We were able to buy a little bit of time to be able to go, what do we actually want to do? So we went another year. The third year was the interesting one, because you don't go to one set of parents for 1 year and another set of parents. Then we went off somewhere else for the third year, and then they were like, oh, sorry. But what happened is it actually meant that there was no big expectations coming from wherever, you know, on us.
In terms of then people who are listening and saying, you know, Ronan, I can identify with a lot of this. I am stressed out. I am anxious. I'd like to not be, but I'm just kind of in this cycle. Yeah. And I've been doing it this way for so long that I actually don't even know where to start. Well, how can people just put things in place to deal with Christmas anxiety?
Okay, first of all, make a little list of the things that you think need to be done. Sit down, do it now. You know, wherever you are, just sit down, pull out a piece of paper or do it on your phone or do whatever you want. Make a list. And then after the list, I want you to write, is this in my control or not? Can I do something about it, or does it need somebody else to do something first?
Yeah.
Then I want you to literally draw a line through the things that are out of your control. You know, there's obvious things, the weather, the traffic, all that kind of thing. But
winning
the actions of other people, I'm waiting for my brother to do X so that I can do Y. You know what? Let it go. Let it figure out. We'll come to it when we have to. What can I do? And do the things that you can. Because the weird thing is, we tend to fret and fret and fret and fret and fret about the things that we can't do anything about. And we avoid doing the things that we actually could be doing something about. And of course, as I've often said to you, Wendy, avoidance equals anxiety multiplied by two. So every time we avoid something, we take that anxiety and double it. If I go and I avoid it a second time, then I've doubled what's already doubled. And by the time I've actually avoided something three or four times in the same day, I'm now up to exponential amounts of anxiety. Whereas if I just went and did it, I'd feel a whole lot better. So do what you can and cross off the list of things that you can't is the first thing. Second thing I'd suggest is the idea, and it's kind of to do with the control thing. And it's like what tends to happen is when things are outside of our control, like I said to you, we sometimes get a bit resentful and fed up and kind of, you know, we also push back against it internally. We do a kind of a resisting, you know, so that when your mother calls up or when your dad calls up saying such and such a thing, you get all kind of, or your brother or somebody or your boss wants something out of you. And you kind of go, well, and you can almost feel it inside yourself. You'll go and do it, maybe, but actually you do it kind of with a heavy heart and probably feeling a little bit resentful. So what I'm going to suggest is, if something's out of your control and you feel like, you know, it's like you need to just take a moment and go, you know what, I can't change that. That's the way it's always been. And I'm going to just go with that. And I'm going to stop using a kind of an anxious energy thinking about what that is. And we do that, don't we? We kind of go, we have little, what I used to say, having conversations with the devil. We imagine we actually have the person in
front
in the
of
room
us. And if you're anything like me, I dream about it. I wake up and I'm in my car having conversations in my head with the person. And you're right, it's draining all your energy.
Yeah, exactly. And it's creating anxiety as well. So what we're doing is we're going to say, okay, instead of having that conversation, I'm just going to find that part of myself that's trying desperately to push back against that. I'm going to choose to not push back. Now, can I tell you, it's easier said than done, but actually once you choose to not push back and not to kind of have those internal arguments and just go, what will be, and we'll let it happen, and trust the rest of the Lord, actually it's a brilliant feeling. It's a brilliant feeling.
There's a great feeling of freedom. So what else can we do in terms of, one of the things I'd say that stresses people out is, you were mentioning it earlier, Ronan, is just the stress that you feel from other people, whether it's crazy supermarket queues, you know, finding yourself having extra road rage because the traffic is different. They are things that we can control because it's our own impatience a lot of the time.
Yeah, I always use the three P's, you know. Is what's happening to me here, is it permanent? Is it pervasive? That means, is it all over the place? And I can't even remember what the third P is. I just remember the idea that you kind of, am I going to... be dealing with this person who's in front of me forever? No, I'm not. Is it pervasive? No, once I get off this road, it'll be on. The third one, is it personal? Is that person in front of me, you know, cutting me off just to annoy me? No, they're not. They don't even know I'm here. So permanent, pervasive, and personal. And if you can use the three P's on yourself, I find them very, very helpful. Because you start getting a little bit of, you can get a bit of a persecution complex when you're stuck in a supermarket queue and somebody cuts you off or somebody in front of you, you know, the person who starts looking for their purse at the end, and it's like, did you not know you were going to have to pay? You know, This is always going to be happening. You're always going to need your purse. How can we take it out of 10 minutes? It's not personal. It's not pervasive. It'll be over in a minute and you'll be fine, you know? The other thing I was going to say that really hit me was, you know, we kind of need to take charge of our thoughts. And this is what I mean. Sometimes we're in the middle of something, in the middle of Christmas dinner, or we're sitting in a kind of a, you know, there's something happening in terms of the stress of preparation. You know, I'm sitting in and I'm peeling carrots or spuds and I'm in the kitchen and everybody's inside watching the TV and I'm just starting to get really, really angry about that. And I need to actually figure out, instead of rushing into my own feeling of anxiety and even anger about that, I need to ask myself, what am I thinking about this situation? I often say to my clients, it's not the thing, it's the meaning of the thing. It's the meaning of, like, what meaning am I doing? The meaning I'm thinking when I'm sitting here is, they don't care about me. They're inside watching TV, having a lovely time, and I'm in here cutting up bits of potato, and they don't care about me, and I feel abandoned, and I feel, you know, so actually, it's the meaning that's upsetting me. So I need to take charge of that, own it, and go, hold on a second. Is there any proof at all that those people don't care about me? They tell me they love me. They behave in a loving way towards me. I need to own that. So it's like, you know, there's a million examples I could give you of those particular types of incidents. So they're really small microcosmic moments throughout the day.
But that can feel really big, upset, as you say, if we don't get a handle on them. Ronan, really good advice for us this morning. Hopefully we will be less anxious and less stressed this Christmas. Thank you so much for joining us.
Very
on the
happy Christmas to you.
And God to you too. That was psychotherapist Ronan Johnston there from Zest Life Counselling. And if you want to get in touch with Ronan, the website there is zestlife.ie. Well, abortion legislation reached its final stages of debate and discussion in the Shannon and the Dáil last week. Now it has just to be signed by President Michael D. Higgins before it becomes law. So what will happen come January when this legislation is meant to be put into practice? Reading today in the papers that the National Maternity Hospital is going to be the first hospital that will provide, for example, abortions in the case where there is a life-limiting condition. Also reported in the papers today was a meeting that Minister for Health Simon Harris held at the weekend, where just 60 GPs, and to put that in perspective, there's 2,500 in the country, turned up for a training meeting. So what is January going to look like when this legislation is put into place? Well, on the line to give us his thoughts on what happens next in relation to abortion in this country, we have independent TD for Meath West, Pádraig Tobin. Pádraig, good morning.
Good morning to you.
So tell us a little bit about the stage we're at now with this legislation. What happens next?
Well, obviously the legislation unfortunately has passed all stages in Leinster House. So the Dáil and the Shannons have passed the legislation, and in my 8 years in Leinster House, I have to say I've never seen anything so aggressive, so fractious, so difficult to deal with. Literally everybody that spoke who opposed this legislation and, you know, put amendments forward, and these amendments were very weak amendments. In reality, they weren't really looking to prevent access in the whole scheme of things, but just to add a little bit of humanity where possible.
Yeah,
on
a lot of people would describe them as almost mercy amendments, you know, mercy for the unborn child at a moment when they can feel pain, for example, before an abortion happens. Is it a horrible indictment of our politicians say, did they have no mercy in this legislation?
Yeah, I think the strategy that the politicians have taken on board has been, especially from Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Sinn Féin and Labour, has been just to close down debate. So in other words, they don't want to allow for anybody to critique the legislation whatsoever. And they've sought, in a way, they sought to get rid of these mercy or humane amendments, because these amendments reflect a humanity back at the unborn child. So if, obviously, they want to proceed with abortion on demand, they must do so in their minds without reflecting the fact that there's a human being involved. And I think that's one of the reasons why they closed down the debate. And the way they closed down debate was with extreme aggressiveness against the few TDs and senators that actually spoke up in support of the human right to life. And I have no doubt that in 30, 40, 50 years' time, people will look back at the level of debate and the style of debate as one of the most extreme natures of parliamentary debate in the history of the state. So we have the situation now where the president has to sign the bill, and then the bill will allow for abortions to be provided from the start of January. And obviously there are preparations going ahead to make that available. But in the background, we have this chorus of doctors and medical experts who are saying that the system is nowhere near ready for the provision of abortion in Ireland whatsoever. And an actual fact that there will be dangers involved if the government proceeds to this timescale that they want. And the strange thing is that Simon Harris has set so much of his reputation on this particular timescale delivery that he is determined to push it through. It's one of the only things that he can claim to have any level of success on, because obviously the whole of the health service is crumbling around him at the same time. And he wants to make sure that the discourse that happens in Irish politics around his activism ignores what's happening in the health service and just focuses what's happening this with regard to the abortion services. So I've spoken to doctors, I've spoken to obstetricians, and they have told me that at all levels there is going to be a massive refusal to participate. And, you know, a number of the hospitals, especially the regional hospitals, I understand the majority of practitioners at all levels have said they're not going to participate. So I think that the government have probably come to an understanding now that there will be a service available, but it will be a skeleton service. In other words, it'll just be operating in a few local areas and maybe one or two hospitals. But to be honest, I think that the government is going to, you know, move, you know, heaven and earth if it can, to then look at the preceding months to push for these services to be provided. And if they don't succeed in providing them through doctors and hospitals, I have no doubt that in a year or two we'll actually see international abortion clinics start to set up in Ireland to provide the service.
In terms of just for now, Patrick, the impact you think that you feel it will have on things like GPs, and as I mentioned, you know, the headline didn't read this way, but just 60 GPs turned up for this training with Minister for Health Simon Harris over the weekend. There's 2,500 of them, so they're not beating down the door to be providing it in their practices, whatever their opinion on abortion is. But what sort of an impact are you worried it's going to have on maternity hospitals and GP practices for those who are providing abortion?
Well, first of all, we know that the health system is broken, and one of the few accesses there exists to the health service currently is through the GP service. And in towns like Navan and Trim and Athboy in my own constituency, you know, we would have people, especially new Irish who are coming to live in those towns, who can't get a GP to sign up to because the GPs are full. If I was to book an appointment currently in the GP in my hometown, I would have to maybe wait a week for an appointment. So stuffed are the GPs currently. Now, the government, I think, has tried to get around that by offering more money for the provision of abortion than it would normally provide for any other provision through a GP. And maybe that's to incentivize the service in a timescale that it seeks. But there's no doubt in my mind that this is going to be chaotic at GP level. And the point I made to the bill was there was no consultation done with the GPs at all. In fact, some of the GPs just found out on the radio when the minister obviously declared that this was to be a GP-led service. Now, if I was to deliver any kind of a bill in Leinster House, any kind of a bill, there would have to be about a year's worth of consultation done in advance.
Yeah, and it was a strange way it was done. Just finally to ask you, because we have to go to news, unfortunately,
sure.
Patters, how do you feel, honestly, that the way that this government has handled the discussion and the beginning of the implementation of this legislation, how do you think they'll be remembered in the history books?
Well, first of all, I think that the way that they're delivering it is chaotic. So even if you're pro-choice, or pro-abortion, you should be asking serious questions, because this could lead to serious threats to the health of mothers, never mind, obviously, the unfortunate children who will have their lives ended. So the chaos that we see in the rest of the health service will be reflected in the chaos that will be delivered in this particular service here. And I've no doubt in years to come, you know, this will be seen as a dark period with regard to human rights in Irish society. The only way to fight this is for people to get politically involved. And obviously I'm involved in the development of a new political organisation across the country. And I'd ask people who are interested to reach out in any way they can and get involved, because we need to make sure that in the future we roll back this unjust service and make sure that we protect all lives and leave no mother or children behind.
Independent TD Pádraig Tibín, thank you so much for joining us on Spirit Radio this morning. Perhaps something I have taken for granted, and many other women that are of a particular age, is the fact that we can freely vote. And it's quite staggering for me to think, because, gosh, I've voted quite a number of times now, is that less than, well, just over 100 years ago, women were not able to vote. Last Friday marked the first 100 years in the first election in which women could vote. Interestingly, there was one woman at that particular time who couldn't vote because she was in prison, even though 2 weeks later she herself would be elected. She was the first female MP to be elected to the House of Commons. It was Constance Markovich. She grew up in Sligo, but it wasn't an easy path leading to this stage. A lot happened to her in her life before she got this actual recognition for the work that she had done. She spent many years in prison, being sentenced with life imprisonment for her political involvement and opinions during the 1916 Rising. It's a pretty good year when you consider the historical backdrop and those 100 years that I've just been talking about, to be looking at this next book, which is really, really interesting, because there was prison letters of Constance Markovich that has been published. They've been released. And this book is looking at that, her letters, and obviously looking a little bit more at her life and her writings. And in studio to tell us more is the writer and journalist who's put this piece of work together, Lindy Naughton. Lindy, thanks for joining us on the programme.
You're welcome.
It's interesting, isn't it, when we have well-known historical figures like Constance Markovich that we still even get the basic facts wrong about
her.
Oh yes,
absolutely.
So we're going to go into some of those interesting facts that you have been able to really clarify in this piece of work. But what do we know about her? Because I'm quite aware that probably for a lot of, especially a younger generation, like I was saying there, there is a kind of perhaps a taking for granted of the realities that modern day women enjoy, when really it's in a relatively short period of history that it was a very, very different time. What was Constance's life like growing up in Sligo as a woman?
Well, she grew up in Lissada. She was born in London because her father was an MP, as it turned out. He was the MP for Sligo. And she grew up in Lissadel House, a very liberal family, it has to be said. Her father was an explorer. He preferred to spend his time up in the Arctic. There's the remains of a whale still in Lissadel House. And it was a life of great privilege, but it was different to that of the other landlords, the absentee landlords. The Gorboots were not absentee landlords. And during the famine, for instance, they were here from the 17th century. We won't go into that bit because it's too complicated. But the family would have been very aware of the needs of their tenants. And when they did their best to look after the tenants during the first famine, and when Constance and her siblings were young, there was a second famine. We're not always told about this, where her mother would have had all the children rounded up to help out with all the local tenants. She was in and out of the tenants' house. She knew all the old stories. She was a devil for a practical joke. She said some terrible things to all the local children, but they were involved with her. She had a little horse called Storeen, a pony she was given at six, that she used to gallop around the place like a little lunatic, and all the locals would just see her going, oh, there she goes, Con from Lissadel House. So she had an idyllic childhood in lots of ways, but it wasn't a socially unaware one. Her brother,
would that have been unusual for that time in terms of the connectivity that she had to those of a lower class to her?
Well, I think somebody said to me, I wrote, the reason I came to Constance was through a biography I wrote about the Irish aviator Sophie Pearce, who grew up in Newcastle West and became well known as Lady Mary Heath, who flew from Cape Town to Dublin. And I remember somebody saying to me about people of that class, of the Protestant class, if you like, although I hate to categorise people like that, that Irish people from that kind of background weren't snobs. You know, they took people as they found them. And the two women I've written biographies about that, and they lived on Leinster Road in Rathmines, by the way, which is the connection. That's how I ended up with Markovich. I was fascinated that two women from, they were very tall, were very outspoken, and very, you know, that really did create small bits of history, grew up on the same, or were living on the same road in 1916 with 30 years of an age difference. But as I say, that comment was made that they took people as they found them. And I think that's why Constance was so loved by ordinary Dubliners who revered her. She was their madam. And she was always, she had kids hanging out of her all the time.
So how did Constance go from galloping around on her pony, you know, this idyllic child of that you speak of, Lindy, to ending up in prison?
Well, she, at the time, it's a complicated story, as I say. Women, we always have to remember the context into which people are born. It's not like today. We cannot judge them by the standards of today. And it's something that I've spent a lot of time researching just that period. I started off with the Olympic Games that were 1896, because I have a huge involvement in sport, as some people might know. And that I've got to know that period very well. People couldn't get around that well. You know, women couldn't earn their living. And women from her kind of background, there was two ways they could earn their living, as she learned through Sarah Purser, who made a portrait of her and her sister Eva, as artists or as music teachers. That was it. So she was badgering her parents to let her go off and study art, which she did in London and then in Paris, where she met her husband, came back to Ireland. Ireland at the time, the Gaelic League was huge, as we know, promoting Irish art, Irish music, by Irish, all that. And it began to have a political edge, which turned into Sinn Féin. So she made that evolution along with a lot of other middle class Irish people, as we know, because most of the 1916 signers of the proclamation were artists and musicians who came from mixed religious backgrounds, very interesting. And so they were all of the same ilk. They were well-educated people who just knew that Ireland as it was could not continue the way it was going.
And something had to change.
And something had to change. So, she wasn't alone.
So how did she go from, you know, connecting up to this political movement, but to then it being, you know, so important to her that that she was willing to go to prison for her beliefs?
When she came to Dublin, one of the striking things I remember, I've written her biography too a couple of years ago, which is where the letters come from, was when her pal later on, called Margaret Skinner, who was an Irish woman living in Glasgow, came to Dublin. Constance decided to show her the sights. What did she show her? Not the Phoenix Park, not Dublin Castle, but the tenements around Mountjoy Square and around there, that part of Dublin, that were just, you know, entire families living in rooms, 10 people to a room, no toilet facilities, no cooking facilities, no maintenance on the buildings, so that they crumbled and fell and the people died in
them.
And
they did, yeah.
And that to her, when she saw that, she just, you know, no sewer, no proper sewerage, like urine just flowing through the streets. This was Dublin. It had the most horrific tenements in Europe at the time. She saw this and she wanted to do something about this. Inevitably, she connected with James Connolly and James Larkin. Inevitably. So she became linked into the movement where the workers' rights and national rights for Ireland were inextricably linked with the votes for women in there as well. So there was three planks to her platform, really.
And then when did prison come? How did she end up being imprisoned?
She ended up being she had her first little brush with the law when King George V visited Dublin. But then, of course, in 1916, she was the only female leader, if you like, at St. Stephen's Green. And afterwards, she was inevitably arrested along with hundreds, if not thousands of others. And she was sentenced to death and to be shot. But she sat there in Kilmainham with the, you know, the water dripping down the walls in that horrendous prison. That was her first experience of proper jail.
How was she treated there?
They were treated terribly. I mean, they were sleeping on the floor. If anyone's visited Kilmainham jail, it's really not that much better now. It was a horrendous place with tiny little windows.
Sort of an insight did her letters give then?
The interesting thing about her is that if you read the letters, it's only in the small letters that she managed to sneak out unofficially that you will get any hint of what was going on. To her family, everything was hunky-dory. She just didn't want... She was a woman... That's what I admire about her the most. She was not a self-centred, narcissistic woman at all, as Sean O'Casey would have accused her of. When you read the letters, and it really changed my mind about her, that's why I wanted them published separately. I want people to make up their own mind about her. She did her absolute level best not to worry the people who loved her. And she never complained. She just knuckled down. She was the best prisoner going. She just did her time.
Fast forward then to her election.
She was in 1918, as we know, there was a huge drive to conscript Irish people by Lloyd George, which was resisted, vehemently resisted. And what they invented, the British then invented this German plot and just rounded up, which was, we won't go into it, but it was rounded up all the Republicans and chucked them into, interned them all. And she ended up in Holloway Prison with Maud Gonne and Kathleen Clark, the widow of Tom Clark. So at that point, then the election was, the war ended, the election was called. Maud Gonne had been released, so the two of them were still in jail, and she was asked to stand as a Sinn Féin candidate in the St Patrick's ward, which would have been the poorest ward in Dublin, where there was no chance she wouldn't be elected, you know, that anyone with a vote would have voted for her. They knew her, she was her their madam, you know,
so, which is part of her legacy. I mean, that's a totally testament to her
legacy. That is, that's why there's the Markovitch swimming pool and the Markovitch, all the things that remember her are related to ordinary life and ordinary people, which I think,
and trying to serve ordinary people.
Yeah, exactly. That was her whole life. She was an agitator, certainly, but the good that she did was often very personal, like going out to the Wicklow Mountains and getting turf and dragging it into her old Thin Lizzie, the car that she loved, which when she drove, it was forever breaking down. And people got used to seeing this pair of legs with knickerbockers on it sticking out from under a car. And they would just go, "Hello, madam." And she'd say, "Hurry, hurry."
There was lots of interesting things about the vote in the year that she was elected.
In what respect?
In terms of the people think that it was on a particular, she was elected on the 14th of December. She wasn't. Was it the first time men over 21
yes.
could vote?
Well, this is the electorate in Ireland alone went up from 200,000 to 2 million. Or I may not have those figures exactly right, but there was a huge increase in the electorate because of the war. Men, it was obvious that they had to give the vote to ordinary soldiers. So that was men over 21. Women over 30 were given the vote. We have to remember this. Not all women were given the vote because they felt that if all women got the vote, they would outvote the men.
Right, so I would have only been allowed to vote possibly two or three times, which puts I think of all the things I wouldn't have been allowed to vote for, puts it in perspective, doesn't it?
Well, it just makes you realise that, you know, I sometimes wonder about the vote, and this is a...
There was still politics being played.
There was still total politics. And the thing is that women were given the vote when they were given the vote. They were allowed to vote in a world that had been created by men to suit men. And I've always had a bit of ambivalence about voting because we are still second-class citizens. I'm sorry. We just are. That's just reality. And some of us rise higher than that. But women, this isn't... We live in a man's world. We still live in a man's world. And in Ireland, in the proclamation, it was declared that all the rights of men and women were equal. It's not, when I read it again recently, I thought it's not quite as specific as I'd like. Mm. But in theory, all Irish men and women had equal rights. Then, of course, when that didn't happen, and that was very disappointing for the people who had fought it, because, as I said, they were the middle class intellectuals, basically. So they weren't representing the working classes, let's face it. And then when Cosgrave got in after, you know, going into Irish history. But as we all know, an extremely right-wing, Catholic, conservative, anti-women regime then got back into power in Ireland.
How do you think, just finally to ask you, Lindy, Countess Markovitch will be remembered? What is her legacy?
Legacy is a funny word. What is her legacy? I mean, we didn't have another minister. She was the minister for Labour, the second in Europe after Alexander Kollontai in Russia. We didn't have another minister for another 60 years. So I think maybe the legacy of her and those other fantastic women of the time, Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, Kathleen Lynn, Madeleine French, the woman Louis Bennett, the yes. trade unionist, Helena Maloney, all of these women, I think people are only beginning to... Rosie Hackett, the Hackett Bridge. We're only now beginning to realise what they did. And maybe, you know, it skipped a number of generations because of this hugely oppressive regime for women in Ireland. But maybe only now we're beginning to realise. I think her legacy, when you read her book, you just think she was just a good woman. She did her best, you know, and she evolved as a human being during her life, which I don't think she's given credit for.
Very interesting indeed. I've been chatting to writer and journalist Lindy Naughton. The book is called Markovitch Prison Letters and Rebel Writings, and it is out now, as they say, and it's coming from merionpress.ie as well if you want to find out more information on that. as I chomped into the little, it was only a mini mince pie now that Therese brought me in earlier, but as I was eating it this morning, I thought, oh, I'm going to regret it because Alex is coming in to talk nutrition. And the thing that we're talking about today is monitoring our sugar intake. It's probably one of those things you don't really want to think about. You know the way sometimes when you're getting advice on being healthy, it's keep a food diary. I'd be a bit nervous if I had kept a food diary even over the last week and indeed, over the coming days. So where is the balance, like, you know, in enjoying Christmas time, in enjoying your Christmas day dinner, but also I saying, okay, let's not lose the run of ourselves. Or if you do, how to get back on track. In the studio to give us some advice on this, we have Alex Dobbs from Grassroots Nutrition. I'm sure you have a sugar-free Christmas, right?
Of course. What are you thinking, Wendy? Yeah, no, I'm just thinking maybe I should have kept a food diary for the last week because, yeah, I've definitely been eating 3-4 times the amount of sugar I would normally eat. You
it's
know?
Just all the little things like yeah. that, the mini mince pies, or everywhere you go, there seems to be. It's not just in work. It's, you know, if you're going to a doctor's surgery or all these little places where there's just always tins of the little sweeties yes. out, and it's very hard to resist.
It is, and it's just people being nice, isn't it? People being in the festive seasonal spirit, and they want to make other people happy. So you know, they're out there to be eaten. I know. Well, I think. The best thing is to just be conscious about what you want to eat this Christmas and what you don't want to eat. So, you know, don't sort of punish yourself saying, I'm not going to eat any sugar, because it's going to be very difficult. But, you know, maybe make the choice of saying, right, when I go to the surgery or when I go wherever in the shop, there might be some little treats. Just I'm not going to take those, because if you know, you might take 10 or 15 of those a week. That's quite a lot of chocolate and sugar. But then instead you might say, okay, when I have my cup of tea at 11, I'm going to have a really nice Christmassy, maybe a mince pie or something like that. So, you know, you are conscious about the sugar that you eat and that you enjoy it. I think mostly our problem lies with the sugar we don't realize we're eating. You know, that's where when I have clients first in, I always ask them to keep a food diary, and I warn them, or I tell them, it's not a test, you can't fail. It's just, let's be conscious about what we eat.
Do you find that when you're working with people that they're shocked when they actually write the stuff down, going, oh my gosh, how much it all adds up, the little kind of picky things that you're at?
I notice that people don't put those on the food diary. You really have to prompt them, you know, because they exclude them. They just, in it, they're so unconscious about it that they don't even put them on the food diary, because I thought, oh, it's only a couple of biscuits. But, you know, we have this lovely calorie counting list here in front of us, and it's the 2 biscuits a day that would take half an hour to walk off. And if you do that over 2 decades, you will gain a stone or two over your lifetime just eating those, unconsciously eating those sugars. So I'm thinking, yeah, we all know that sugar is addictive. We all know we shouldn't be eating too much. We all know we're eating too much, but let's just at least enjoy it while we're doing
There's
it.
There's a lot of sugar in alcohol as well.
Yes, that's the other thing. Exactly. So you do consume quite a bit of calories just drinking alcohol. So maybe alternate, have one glass of wine, have one glass of water. You know, it prevents the hangover the next day, but also it rehydrates you, which is massively important. It keeps you a little bit fuller, and you do end up drinking less alcohol.
Sugar is addictive, right? And we've talked about this before, but any other type of addiction, obviously the more you have, the more you want. Can you almost increase your sugar addiction just in the kind of weeks leading up when you're nibbling on all the extra sweet stuff?
Oh yeah. See, the thing is, every time you eat sugar, you send a message to your brain, to certain areas in your brain that just signal you back, I want more. And again, it's what I talk to people quite a lot about. It's you train your gut, you train your taste buds, and you train your brain. So you train these areas to want more, or to sort of lie dormant and go, oh, well, there's no sugar around anyway, so I might as well just be quiet. So, yes, you do actually train yourself to just want more and more all the time.
So you could end up having a little bit of a sugar detox then.
Yes, exactly. So we'll talk about that next time, maybe.
But in terms of just things, I think there's probably a lot of food and drink that have hidden, like that we don't automatically think, oh, that's sugary or that's really calorific.
Yes.
What are they? What are the things to look out for that we should be going, okay, have less of that, or just decide to have it on one particular day or whatever?
Yeah. So any sort of Christmassy sweet treats, like mince pies or whatever. So just be aware that that is quite a lot of sugar you're eating. And there are treats, so when you do eat them, be conscious and, you know, don't just eat them maybe while you're driving the car or walking around or whatever. The other thing is wine and any kind of alcohol. Beer is very full because it doesn't just have the alcohol, it's got a lot of other carbohydrates as well. So that's a lot of carbohydrates and sugar that you can take. The sweeter, usually, the more sugar. So if you have
ciders and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. Or for example, if you drank a gin and tonic with a slimline tonic, maybe, you know, you'd reduce the sugar there. The other thing is...
And there's a lot of fizzy drinks going around as well.
Yeah, exactly. Fizzy drinks. So I was actually, you know, that's always the thing that you try to recommend people is when they're trying to cut down on wine and then they drink these sugary fizzy drinks that supermarkets sell instead of wine. I think you're better off to maybe just flavor your water with some lemon and some mint. You know, maybe be inventive, put some rosemary and cucumber in. You think it sounds mad, but it's actually delicious. Or some basil, you know, make it like what would you would put into some like a gin and tonic and have some fizzy water. And then you'll end up having, you know, really nicely flavored water that doesn't contain any calories. Or if you do drink those drinks, then maybe pour a little bit of fizzy water on top so you just dilute them.
That's the thing I find interesting about trying my best to cut back on a little bit of sugar is when you do then have these sugary drinks. I, for example, a lot of the stuff, even a kind of 7-Up or a Schlur, these types of things, I would say I could only have kind of one part of that to about 5 or 6 parts water because I just find it so sweet, like it's sickly sweet.
Yeah, it's the training your taste buds, isn't it?
Yeah, so can you retrain them?
Oh yeah, and it takes 3 weeks to form a new habit. So 21 days is what you have to give yourself before you are allowed to say, I can't do this or have to try again.
Yeah.
But so always, even with now, after Christmas, be good to yourself, you know? And now also, just remember, every time you put something into your mouth, you're training yourself again. So the other thing I always say is make sure you have your 3 square meals a day. Don't skip meals because you've eaten something at 11. Don't skip lunch because your blood sugars will drop invariably, especially if you've eaten something sweet at 11. And then you'll be very hungry come 2 or 3 o'clock and then you'll eat something sweet again and you'll be grumpy and tired and starving by dinner. So it's no point doing that. So have a decent breakfast, maybe some protein if you can or you know, like eggs or even smoked salmon. Treat yourself to something nice or porridge, whatever. And then have a really good lunch, maybe a soup or a salad or a sandwich. You know, have something that sustains you and then carries you through to dinner.
What about the other part of this? And I know it's kind of monkey see, monkey do, but I'm thinking as well for a lot of kids and for some toddlers, it'll probably be the first time when they've had quite a bit of sugar. And it just seems, I mean, we were over in a friend's house yesterday and I don't know, Matthew can smell the sugar. Mm-hmm. And there was cupcakes and macaroons and chocolate biscuit cake and all this sort of stuff. And anyway, he had a tiny little bit and he's probably
that was probably
the most sugar he's ever had. But how do you manage it when it comes to kids? Again, you're trying to have that balance of look. You don't want to be a Grinch, but you want to look after them as well.
Exactly. So I just talk to them. I mean, I have 4 young children. They're at that age where they all make their own decisions. And I talk to them even on a daily basis. You know, you just tell them, look, it's okay to eat a biscuit, for example, after church every Sunday. We have 2 biscuits. Sometimes I'm sure they tell me they have 2 and they have 4. But the point is that you make them just aware of what they're eating. And I make them eat their lunch before they have anything else. So yesterday we had a big family celebration and they're all just sort of pushing the food around on the table. But I said, look, you're not going to get your cake or your chocolate if you don't eat your lunch. Normally I wouldn't even give them a dessert at home, so you know you wouldn't be dangling that carrot in front of them all the time because then they only eat to get the sugar. But no, make sure they have a solid foundation, make sure they have eaten something decent, you know, feed them if you have to, but then they can have a little bit of sugar and obviously reduce the amount of sugar around. So don't buy too much. You know, I know the celebration boxes is only €3.50 and it's a special offer. Buy one, don't buy 3 or 4.
You will just eat them if you're anything like me.
That's the thing.
One of the things that there was a story last week, which I can totally understand, is that over Christmas, the average person puts on around £2.
Yes.
And then what happens is those £2 stay on and 5 years later, you're nearly a stone heavier. Is there a way that you can just keep the extra pounds off so you don't put them on in the first place, basically?
Absolutely. For example, I was just, we have this lovely calendar of family photos that we make for my parents every year. And of course, I'm way late this year sending on the photos so we can make the calendar. And there I was looking through my last winter's photos and we went to Glendalough and had a lovely walk. You know, we went... where we played in the snow quite a bit, obviously, which hopefully we can do again. So keep active. You know, £2 is not impossible to burn over a 2-week period. So when it comes to January and all the season is over, do get out. A 20-minute walk, a 30-minute walk, brisk walk, even, you know, if you want to do a little jog or do a nice long walk at the weekend. The weather isn't that bad. You know, we're in Wicklow here. Climb the Sugarloaf, go to the Wicklow Mountains somewhere, go to a nice park like Kilruddery or even Shangana Parks. Lovely walking. So, you know, do something fun, outdoorsy. It also gets rid of all the sugar out of the kids. They're much happier afterwards.
They'll sleep much better.
So you will lose the pounds.
Do you think as well, there's finally, just ask Alex, is there too much focus on unhealthy snacks. Like, there's lots of lovely, healthy snacks that you can have out at Christmas time.
Yeah, I think, we just don't have the option. And the simplest solutions in life, or the best, are the simplest. So, yeah, bring some carrot sticks and celery sticks, cucumber, mosh, too, sugar snap peas, anything like that. I mean, I often just put them out on the table even while they're doing their homework or before dinner.
With a bit of hummus or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. And they just eat them without even thinking. And you'd be the same. If you put them around the kitchen while you're preparing food, you know, you will snack on those rather than looking at the biscuits in the tin. Because we are hungry, our blood sugars are low, and we're craving for food. So, yeah, eat those veggie sticks. And the other thing is, if you know you're going places and you want to be aware, don't hesitate to bring your own little food, or, you know, just... bring, or say, look, I'm making starters, and bring a lovely salad. It's very simple. You know, it's cheap and it's easy. Just pull open a few bags of green leaves, chop over a few tomatoes.
Or if you're just going to a party where, you know, there's going to be nibbly bits where it's all deep fried, bad stuff for you, eat before. Don't go hungry.
That's the other thing, exactly. Have a little bit of a snack beforehand. And, you know, maybe bring another option, unless whoever you're going to would feel offended by that. You have to be careful.
Depends on the host. As always, great advice from our nutrition coach, Alex Dobbs from Grassroots Nutrition. If you want to get in touch with Alex, her website is grassrootsnutrition.ie. Thanks a million for joining us, and happy Christmas to you and your family, where you're going to have a healthy Christmas, I know for sure.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.